Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone and the Libertarian Institute. Today I'm joined by Derek Wills. He is the author of The Liberty Solution, which he didn't co-write with Dr. Walter Block, but Walter Block did write the foreword for this. So that alone is a great accomplishment. Mr. Wills, is Amazon the best place to find the book?
Absolutely. Amazon is... has been wonderful. You can also find it on Audible, which is an Amazon company, and Kindle Unlimited, of course. Amazon is the best place for that.
The book is titled The Liberty Solution. What is this a solution to? What kind of problem is there that we need liberty to solve?
Well, liberty is, you know, I take a lot from John Locke and natural right theory in order to push the narrative that liberty is quintessential. It is a natural right. It is something that we all are entitled to. And what we see on a day-to-day basis is more and more involvement from the state into our everyday lives. And so this is the solution to those types of usurpations that the state constantly puts upon us, either on an individual basis or even as a collective.
It seems like my family has much more of an impact on me than the state does. There's a lot of businesses and corporations that are constantly changing my options in life, constantly changing the way things are in the world. Why is it the state that you focus on in this book as opposed to all other institutions in society?
Well, the state is probably the most egregious actor in society. The state has a monopoly on violence, and they will exercise that monopoly on violence to enforce the most superfluous laws that ever can be. Just an example, I saw a news article not too terribly long ago that a homeowner was killed by police over essentially a disagreement over how tall his grass was. It was insane. And, you know, whenever you put things into perspective like that, you can have probably some of the most bitter rivalries with your family or your neighbors, and it will likely not get to that extent. Is it impossible? No, not at all. But the state's monopoly on violence and desire to coerce people is morally bankrupt at the very least.
How long ago were you in the Navy, and what was your role in the Navy?
I entered the Navy in June of 2005, and I spent 6 years there. I got out in 2011. I was what's called a fire controlman. I worked on fire control systems on board cruisers, which was the 5-inch gun battery, the main guns on the forward and aft section of the ship, the fire control system that controls that. So that was essentially my role, was anytime to make sure that the ship was protected from any sort of threat that either standard missiles or the like could not handle.
The estimates I've heard are about 22 veterans a day committing suicide. That seems to be on the higher end of estimates I've heard. Do you have a general thesis as to why there is such a high suicide rate among people who we might think of as very courageous and very mentally strong?
When you put anybody into a situation like war, they see and do things that are very hard to live with. The mental scars that they carry are the English language doesn't possess the vocabulary to adequately articulate it. And sadly, you know, it's difficult to deal with, even if you are in therapy, because you're doing something so extraordinary that really the human psyche isn't prepared to process, doesn't know how to process that. And the level of trauma that I've seen just from my friends that have served as well, it's incredibly heartbreaking. And I've lost a couple of friends to their battles with PTSD. And it is, you know, whenever you have to... It's hard to describe these types of situations. It really is. And it's even difficult for me to really talk about a lot. But, you know, a lot of these people are doing things that they would never in their worst nightmares dream of having to do. because of the situation that they have been put in.
That has been one of the most incredible things that I've come across in sort of researching very lightly in this area, is the human mind's ability to justify their actions and to constantly keep moving this goalpost. It ultimately comes down to, well, if I don't do it, someone else will, and they might do a worse job. So really, by me being involved in this thing, even if it's generally unjustified, well, I'm actually doing a positive service because there are people far worse than I who will sort of fill this vacuum if I don't do it. What do you say to someone who has maybe some reservations about joining, but still sees joining the military as more or less getting on the side of the good guys? And even though you don't agree with everything the U.S. government does, hell, it's much better than China, Russia, or Saudi Arabia were the global empire.
I would highly encourage them to take a look at real history, everything from the 1953 coup in Iran up until present day, if not before. Because while we generally think of the United States as the quote-unquote good guys, the United States government has been guilty of some severe atrocities across the world. And, you know, it's been done by people who unfortunately have been conditioned to believe and propagandized to believe that what they're doing is somehow right and just. And I would highly encourage anybody who is considering joining the military to reconsider that stance, because the things that they will find themselves in will likely be something that is not what they expected. And if given the chance to actually think about the position that they would find themselves in, if they had the chance to actually process that, would object to it. But given the circumstances and the heat of the moment, they would end up carrying out those acts and then live with those scars for the rest of their lives.
When I generally refer to myself as, maybe you could say, a pacifist, all I am simply saying is I have a strong presumption against entering into a conflict and virtually have no double standard for the state or any other organization when it comes to conflicts like this. Primarily, the reasons would be the costs of war are so incredibly high. The major war that they all brag about in the American ruling class is the Second World War, which killed like 60 million people. That's the good one. And the other good one in the 1860s killed like 600,000 Americans and left another 500,000 blind and had their limbs blown off and tons of PTSD there. So one, the costs are astronomically high. Second, it's all based on deception, what Sun Tzu said, but that's a different discussion. The likelihood of you knowing what the outcome will be is far different than, well, if I see a drowning child, should I risk my life and save them? Well, yes. Well, in that case, you are likely to know what the outcome is. When you're like, all right, let's kill Saddam and Gaddafi and Assad, you have no clue what the result is going to be. And of course, it's going to be empowering groups like Al-Qaeda in this case. Or you have no clue what Afghanistan... You know what? I shouldn't say that they didn't have a clue of what Afghanistan would yield, considering it happened to the Soviets just like a few decades before. So I can't excuse everything they do. So I'm going to say those are my two justifications. Initiates violence against peaceful people. The costs are astronomically high, and you don't know what the outcome is. How would you make the case for what it means to be an anti-war libertarian?
Well, I mean, what does it mean to be a libertarian generally? You know, you believe that you have the right to do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt anybody. And it's that little caveat at the end, as long as you don't hurt anybody. Well, war is, in its very nature, is hurting other people. It is aggressing against other people. And, you know, justify it however you will. You know, if you're going to voluntarily support that type of position, you need to make sure that what you're supporting is true and honest. You need to make sure that what is fueling your beliefs to side with that type of military intervention is rooted in 100% fact and not propaganda. The state will always, always, always propagandize their reasons for being involved, whether it be the vague euphemism of interests overseas, quote unquote. What are those interests and why does it matter? Are you parroting talking points that you heard from Fox News, CNN, or your favorite propaganda machine? Or have you significantly studied the issue and have come to your own conclusions? Sadly, most people find themselves in the latter position. And, you know, I'm at the point now where I'm always going to be against the next war, because it's, like you said, the cost is too high, not only taxpayer money, but, you know, the lives that we send to either die on the battlefield or come home and deal with the demons that they now have to live with for the rest of their lives. And that's if they survive, you know, dealing with those. It's heartbreaking to see on a personal level whenever you see somebody struggling with these sorts of things. You know, if you support this, are you going to be, would you be willing to be at the front lines? Would you be willing to sacrifice yourself, sacrifice your sons, your daughters, whatever, in order for this cause? And if the answer even has just the remotest amount of hesitation, then it should be no.
When you say people can do anything they'd like so long as they don't hurt others, do you think we could narrow that down a little more, considering almost it's incredibly difficult for people to, if I change where I shop, the business is hurt. Woman breaks up with me, that hurts me. Is there any way we could more narrowly define what it means to be a freedom advocate or a libertarian?
Absolutely. And I will pull an excerpt from my book where I lay this out in chapter one, where the title of the chapter is "What is Liberty?" So it's designed to come from a very from this type of premise. So liberty is natural and concrete. Her definition must be one that is universal to every individual on the planet. And so she must be defined as follows: the right of the individual to invoke sole dominion over their own life to act as they see fit, provided the act in and of itself does not directly infringe on the right of another individual to do the same. So if you have a choice of shopping at shop A or shop B, and you don't like the way shop A does business practices or their political contributions or whatever the case may be, your choice to shop at shop B, it's not really bringing direct harm to them. You're not infringing upon their right to live their life as they see fit. You're making a choice, a free market choice. But if you decide to, I don't know, destroy a window, then you are directly infringing upon that business owner's ability to run their business. And so you are infringing upon their liberty.
Chapter 6 is titled "The Privilege of Life." What is the privilege of life?
Well, I titled that chapter from how I perceive that the state views us. You have the right to life, but given the state's views of us and how they will use their monopoly on violence against us in order to coerce us into acting a certain way, then life is treated as a privilege from the state's perspective. You know, be it capital punishment, be it, you know, a traffic stop that ended deadly because the officer, quote unquote, feared for his life after he shot an unarmed person. Or, you know, somebody, I used an example of an individual in Oklahoma who sadly passed away because he was on probation at the time. He was driving his motorcycle and a cop went to pull him over. It turns out that he had about $2,000 in cash and was in possession of methamphetamine at this time. So he had to make a decision. Do I go back to prison and no longer be a father to my children, no longer be present in my children's lives, or do I flee? And he ended up fleeing. And sadly, he ended up wrecking his motorcycle and falling off of an overpass. And he was put into a situation where he had to make a decision that if liberty was our number one priority in our culture, he would never have had to have made.
Do you have any ideas on, if we say liberty is the highest end, do you have any ideas as to what could sort of supplement those things? One big example might be, if people have a family and have good jobs and are very active in their religious community, they're much less likely to fall for the scams of the Democrats and the Republicans. Do you have any ideas on major institutions or organizations that can supplement indirectly the attempt to achieve liberty in our lifetime or in the future?
Well, there are plenty out there. Libertarian Institute's one, the Mises Institute. As long as we are pushing the ideas of self-ownership and that, owning yourself is the best state of an individual, that is definitely something that is beneficial. And there are plenty of organizations out there that do it to at least one extent or another. I would like to see more advocacy in the forms of things that people more strongly resonate with. Just as an example, my book it's a philosophical treatise. It's not exactly the sexiest of genres, and it's never going to make the New York Times bestseller list because it's not something that people want to read. But if we were to, say, novelize those concepts in something that people can find entertainment in, that would be a good idea. And that's actually something that I'm considering doing, is writing a novel rooted in these principles that I laid out in my first book. Or maybe if we could come up with our own TV series, something like that. I know that all that sorts of thing costs money, but that seems to drive public opinion about a lot of things. And if we could find a way to tap into those types of resources and bring the ideas of liberty that are not propagandized from the statist perspective, I think that would have a huge impact on it.
When it comes to what you titled Chapter 12, the privatization of money, why is it important to privatize money as opposed to having a publicly funded state monopoly on the currency?
Well, whenever you have a monopoly, you don't have choice. Whenever you don't have choice, then you're victim to whatever market trends happen to happen. And, as we've seen since the institution of the Federal Reserve, we've lost over 96% of the value of our currency. That is something that we will never get back, ever. And it is all because of the centralization of power to control our currency. With a private monetary system, we have the freedom of choice. We just have seen the crypto market get decimated lately, but all markets have been decimated. In that decimation, we saw a crypto project called Luna go from $100 a token to now being completely worthless. If that ever happened to the dollar, because of the fact that it's a monopoly, people would lose everything. They wouldn't have the chance to get out of that market and put it into something else, not effectively anyway. Having this type of control over your money, which, if we're being frank, is the tangible representation of the fruits of your labor. If that is getting devalued and you have nowhere else to go with it, then you have lost the fruits of your labor. Having a private monetary system where we have options, we have competition, we have choice, we can save the value of the fruits of our labor no matter what the circumstances are.
If I'm someone who considers myself to be a progressive, care very much about equality and making sure the least among us have at least some basic necessities met and a lot of opportunity in the future. If that is my worldview, why should I be a libertarian instead of a Democrat?
If you care about the most vulnerable among us, then you need to care about their ability to have individualism at its height, to live their lives as they see fit. The individual is the biggest minority that can possibly exist because it is... it is down to the one. There is only one individual. So if you care about these sorts of things, then you need to make sure that you recognize that their ability to live their lives is recognized and protected. The free market and voluntarism and freedom of, you know, in the absence of the state means that everybody lives in on an equal playing field. It doesn't mean that everybody will be equal per se, but it truly is an equal playing field. You know, you really only have three types of societies that can exist: either a monarchy, which is ruled by one, a hierarchy that we have now, which is ruled by many, or anarchy, which is ruled by the self. So if you rule yourself, then you have the power to help out those more than any other institution could. If there is a private charity that is set up with the mission to help individuals, that is going to have far more of an impact on that individual's life than any sort of government program ever could. And they would have a fiduciary duty to help those people because that's their mission. That's part of their reason for existing, if not their very reason for existing. And in order to meet those types of goals, they would need to have as little outside control as possible from the state. And therefore, they would be able to run much more efficiently. And if they weren't doing their job the way that they saw fit, somebody else can step into that market and compete with that charity and make sure that the most vulnerable and susceptible to these sort of circumstances would be taken care of far more effectively.
It's so important because the progressive will sort of fear that those in power will take advantage or heavily exploit those without power. Now, the existence of a state not only doesn't stop this from happening, it actually assists it. So we go from a situation where Vanderbilt, Carnegie, and Rockefeller, and Bezos can't get a penny out of my pocket unless I voluntarily give it to them in exchange for a product or service. That is the free market approach. But with the state, it's like, well, now they can have access to trillions of dollars. And if we don't like it, well, then we'll get put in a cage and shot if we resist. Doesn't exactly sound like the pro-choice message I hear in other aspects of this, but it almost harnesses this greed or self-interest, and it like transforms it into something that is only able to flourish if they're able to meet consumer demand or help their fellow man. Just as you're not entitled to a second of someone else's time unless they voluntarily give you their time, not entitled to anyone else's money. And it also improves their well-being. If you just took a bunch of people and said, people have to associate with you no matter what, it's not likely they're going to be a very high quality to be around. But if they know I'm not entitled to anyone's time, well, then they have to work on their personality. They have to offer things to other people. So that's why I think this book is so important, that increases the ability for people to achieve their ends in a harmonious positive sum way, as opposed to a zero sum way. When it comes to communicating to people who might see the world as civilization versus barbarianism and a need for a Leviathan to stop a war of all against all on the right, how do you communicate the importance of this liberty message to people on the right without taking away their identity?
That's a good question. So think about this for a second. What does the state actually do? What does the government actually do? You know, they really fulfill the definition that people typically worry about whenever it comes to a free society. You know, the warmongers taking over and forcing people into slave camps and, you know, forcing them to do things. That's exactly what the state does. That's what the governments of the world have always done. If you want to truly explore and own your identity, then the only way to do that is in the absence of the state in a free society, because there will be nobody that can dictate to you how you must live. It's voluntary. It is entirely up to you. Nobody will have control over you. Right now, the state controls you. They control the way that you think. They control the way that you act, because if you don't think or act in that certain way, if it becomes enough of a problem, then they will absolutely use violence against you. You know, I mean, just take traffic stops, for instance. How many of those end in violence when no aggression from the driver was ever initiated? You know, Philando Castile is a great example of that. He did nothing violent and yet died as a result of this supposedly, you know, innocent traffic stop. And this isn't just one example. You got a Tatiana Jefferson in Fort Worth who was shot and killed during a welfare check. These sorts of things would never happen. And you certainly wouldn't have the notions of like qualified immunity or, you know, these frivolous warrants, like what was executed against Breonna Taylor or Duncan Lemp, that just, you know, ended up legitimately killing people, and nobody is held accountable. So if you want to live your life as you see fit, the state's existence only hinders that. Period. Full stop. The state's existence will prevent you from living your best life in accordance with your own terms.
And it's not like there's two societies, one where everyone does things by themselves and then one where we do things together, as is so often the scam perpetrated. I think it was Bill Clinton who just really nailed down that falsehood. Or maybe it was Barack Obama saying, you know, the government is the one thing we all have in common as Americans, as if you could like do anything on your own. If you're talking to yourself, well, you didn't invent the English language and you didn't invent the topics that you're thinking of. Or if you're playing solitaire on the computer, well, you didn't invent the game. You didn't invent cards. You didn't invent the ink that's put on the cards, let alone the game or the electricity your computer's using. It's like all of these different organizations are constantly cooperating to have, say, this conversation. We're on StreamYard. I'm using a laptop and a different microphone. People are always cooperating. The question is, will this be done on a voluntary basis or a violent one? And this book, I was able to read two chapters. I read the one on money and the one on justice. I got quite a bit on my plate now, but I promise I will get to it. And that's why I think this is so important. I want to ask two more questions about the time you spent in the military. What is the best lesson you learned, or the most important thing you learned, to keep it positive in this case, while you were in the military?
Oh, that's a good question. I learned a lot of what not to do, if that makes sense. It taught me how to deal with a lot of the stressors in my life. To learn that wasn't exactly a positive experience, but I would say overall, in the big picture, it taught me how to deal with those in a much more positive way. But I'm kind of lucky in that aspect. I didn't see combat during my tenure. So it was something that definitely had a benefit to that. I would say that's probably really one of the only positives about my time in the military.
And as far as any major misconceptions that citizens have about the military, what would you say is that biggest misconception there?
I'm probably going to get a lot of hate for this. But we don't serve our country. We serve the political elites, and we serve them in a very twisted game of political chess where real lives are on the line. It is tragic. Don't get me wrong. The civilian population genuinely has a deep appreciation for members of the military, and that's not lost on me. But I find it a little off-putting to be thanked for my service. I don't like it because I didn't serve our country. I didn't defend our freedoms. My first deployment, I was guarding an Iraqi company's oil platform in the middle of the North Arabian Gulf. That is not an American interest. That is not defending American liberty, if you will. And quite honestly, a lot of members of the military, myself included at the time, believe that we're doing something, to serve something far greater than ourselves. And unfortunately, it's just not true. And it breaks my heart to say that because of the sacrifices that many people that I know and don't know have made. And I wish that it didn't have to come to constantly putting people's lives on the line, their mental health on the line. And it all stems from really just serving the political elites, and it's sad, and I find it evil and disgusting, and I wish that it would stop.
Well, thank you for, I could tell that that wasn't too enjoyable to say, but then again, our great-grandfathers had their limbs blown off and were conscripted to fight for freedom, so maybe we can risk being unpopular and getting a few frowns our way. It's difficult, but sometimes you gotta bite that bullet, so to speak. When it comes to how you could prove something like this, because it sounds just very pessimistic, it's not for the masses, it's for the few. We get this with a lot of things. You know, Trump and Bernie popularize themselves off this rhetoric that a few people, the deep state or the 1%, are benefiting at the expense of everyone else. I think my general proof of this would be, well, one, they're not very interested in letting us opt out of funding them. And if this was in my interest, I would be able to opt out. Two, a lot of times when I ask soldiers about what they did in the military, I almost like am intentionally interrogating them because I want to see how each, you know, member of the military viewed it. And I can always learn from people who've had very different backgrounds than I do. A lot of them are very like standoffish and they don't feel like I'm entitled to the knowledge. But if you're my employee, then really you owe me this explanation. I mean, what, $700 billion a year? Can you not tell me what goes on in some of these places? So it's like they don't seem to have this obligation when it comes to anything that you want. But when it comes to things that they're already doing, well, then they say that that is in the interest of tons of people who can't opt out of funding them. When it comes to people in the military, what is the biggest misconception people in the military have about the state?
That we are the good guys. Unfortunately, we're not the good guys. And if you deep dive into history, legitimate history, that painting becomes more and more clear. You know, we are told that we are the good guys. We are told that what we are doing is right and just and necessary and good and all of these wonderful things. But whenever you get down to the real reasons of these types of operations, you realize that that's all a lie to just get us to comply with whatever orders that we're given. And I just hate that so much because yeah. The United States government is not the good guys at all.
And I think it's so important to differentiate because people will, when you say the U.S., they might literally think you're talking about the whole country or even the government. Well, you know, I know some government employees. What you're really talking about, or at least what I'm generally referring to, is a number of people who occupy government and co-conspirator positions, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, who have more or less attempted to achieve their ends without any basic understanding for thou shall not murder, thou shall not steal. So it's not like people literally believe that we're saying they're bad, or it's like, you know, Robin DiAngelo talking about how bad whites are. Like she thinks, oh, this makes me good because I'm bringing my own group down. We're literally talking about a parasite on this thing we love called America. Just as I wouldn't say, you know, Asians are the problem because of Genghis Khan and Pol Pot and Mao Zedong. What we're really talking about is a microscopic parasite that attempts to siphon off the productive capacities of these groups, Americans, you know, the people in other countries that we genuinely can appreciate. So do you have anything that you say to members of the military that get them to maybe not react with such hostility? Because, I mean, God, that's got to be almost impossible to hear. You've been doing something for years. This is where your paycheck comes from. How do you softball it to them without threatening their worldview and them seeing you as the enemy?
That is a question I have not yet figured out the answer to. I am trying. My best hope is that they can understand that, you know, I come from a place of genuine love and concern for them. And, you know, I do try and convey that. But it is difficult conversations to have You know, I have friends that are still in the military right now. You know, I have friends that I've known since I got in that are still in and I'm not. And, you know, it's hard to tell them that what they're doing, is predicated on a lie. And, I do want to be mindful of their feelings and I do want to be mindful for their well-being. And honestly, I have not figured out exactly how to go about having that conversations. I've touched on it a little bit with a few of them, very few. But the best that I can really kind of hope for right now is that they read my chapter on foreign interventions and it starts to make them think a little bit. But that's kind of the only option that I have at the moment. I don't want to tarnish these friendships, and I certainly don't want to be disrespectful to their ideals. Because, you know, I firmly believe that their rationale behind this is not something that is, you know, they're doing maliciously, and I don't want it to seem like that's what I'm accusing them of. So it's a very delicate scenario. And, you know, maybe I should be a bit more active in trying to figure out a solution to that. But, you know, at the same time, I don't want to alienate anybody. You know, that's not my goal. I want to bring people together.
Yeah. A couple things just sort of come to mind. Telling people that you, the word tricked is so bad, but it's like, you don't want to say, it's not that you're evil. It's that you've been tricked into thinking evil is good. When it comes to something like, gosh, the Iraqi sanctions in the 90s, I mean, can we pick any one of these at random almost, or siding with Al-Qaeda in Syria? It's like you have the Biden's national security advisor talking in his emails about how we're on AQ's side in the fight against Assad. I mean, just all, it's so unbelievable what they can get people to justify mass murder campaigns in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. So one of the things was that I've tried, and I've gotten emails from people saying they claim to be in the military and that they appreciate the show, is one saying it's not that you are evil, it's that you've been tricked into thinking good is bad and vice versa. Second, almost, you know, fell for the same thing. I tried to go when I was 16. My parents wouldn't sign off. That was a whole ordeal. And then, if you explain to them that this idea has actually a very long history, it's not like, well, a bunch of lefties say that, you know, the military is like, you know, this Bob Dylan approach where it's just for the big guys kind of thing. If you take this from the right and say, you know, there's this guy, Smedley Butler, who has medals from wars going back 100 years. And he wrote a book, War is a Racket, and this was his conclusion. And then a World War II general who later became president, Eisenhower, used the term military-industrial complex. You know, Donald Trump has explicitly used the term military-industrial complex. So once you're, one, stripping away your criticism of them and making it and bringing them to your side and saying, look at this thing that we can both criticize. And by the way, it's not just me. It's people who in any other situation you would regard them as heroes. Could you imagine if someone got to shake hands with Smedley Butler or Dwight Eisenhower and they're like, you know, a big member of the military? They'd be shocked that they could meet someone like this. But both increasing the amount of authority behind your position by saying people for a long time in the highest, most respected positions also agree with me, and letting them know that you are on the same side as them. Those are things that have worked with me. Is anything else? Anything else about the book that people should know or that you'd like to tell the audience?
Well, this was a passion project. And you know, one of the things that I challenge the reader to do is to understand that it is okay to change your positions on things. As I was writing it, I changed my position on a lot of things because I researched these particular topics. And because you might find yourself at odds with your philosophy in one area versus another, you can reconcile that, and it doesn't make you a bad person. It actually, quite the contrary. That's how we grow in ourselves and and our philosophies. So, you know, I'm not saying that you have to agree with everything that I say. But if you are honest with yourself and you really do delve down into why you believe everything that you believe, you know, you might find out that you hold some inconsistent positions, and that's okay. And you can reconcile that. And that is growth. You know, when I first started writing it, I was a fairly hardcore libertarian. And then I, transitioned to more of a minarchist, so to speak. And then by the time I was done with it, I was completely done with the idea of the state at all. And, you know, I'm advocating for the abolition of the state entirely. And that's okay. You can change your positions on things. It is not a negative thing to do in any way, shape, or form. In fact, it is a very positive thing to do.
One more thing came to mind with communicating to anyone, really. If we take this concept of the military and we bring it back to principles that are unique to our side, or that we, you know, share with, let's say, the progressives, we could say, we just want the military to embrace the principle of equality, where they don't have any rights that no one else has. So they could specialize in fighting off the bad guys. Look, the reality is, if Jack is assaulting Jill, and I don't know either of them, should I be an isolationist? No, it's all right for me to intervene. What's not okay is if I just start nuking the places that Jack allegedly lives in and start detaining people who once had a phone call with him. So it's not that we're against defense. We're against initiating violence against the innocent people. So we can still bring in our own ideas without saying, yeah, this whole thing called the military and defense, we got to take it all down. We just have to say, you know what? We just have two caveats. You don't get any rights that no one else has, which includes being able to, well, really, that's the only thing. You don't get any rights no one else has. So got to give people a day in court. None of this Gitmo nonsense. You have to fund yourself voluntarily and embrace the principle of the right that God has given you on the sixth commandment, thou shall not murder. So this alone allows us to harmonize our position without sacrificing it. We're not taking away anyone's identity. We're bringing in principles that the right and the left feel that they have a general allegiance to. Because you could just see, did you watch Dave Smith on Patrick Bet David's show?
I did not, unfortunately.
So it seemed like what they were communicating was so wildly different that Patrick Bet David was like, oh, so much has to change in order for this to be embraced. When really, it sounds like we're against everything and we're really just against one thing, which is initiating aggression. And that's why the Liberty Solution I thought was such a great contribution. And how'd you score the Walter Block introduction? What an achievement.
Yeah, that was I still can't believe this. I published it back in August, and I still cannot believe that he wrote the foreword to it, and I can't believe the foreword that he wrote. It was so humbling and complimentary. It really is the it's amazing, and I still get kind of giddy about it. But what happened was, I was kind of stuck on getting another libertarian, a popular libertarian to write the foreword. And I had reached out to this person, early on. And they had said, I'll consider it. Well, let me know whenever you're done with the manuscript. This person started making some tweets that I just really could not reconcile with anymore. I found it to be a little problematic. So I decided that I was not going to use this person. And, so I made a post in one of the LPMC groups on Facebook. Hey, this was my intention, but, now I can't in good conscience have this person, endorse my work. Who would you recommend? And, Stephen Clyde, recommended Walter Block. And he said, he's very approachable. Just shoot him an email and see what happens. I shot him an email. He said he would be more than happy to read it and write a forward. And that's how it came out to be. And I still can't believe it. It truly is amazing. And I am so appreciative to Dr. Block for writing the forward. And it was great kind of talking with him about this, and I just can't say enough about it. I love this aspect entirely, and I feel so great about it, and I'm very proud.
The book is The Liberty Solution. Derek Wills, thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.